and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the grudging acceptance by Donald Trump of the need to condemn Saturday's violence by neo-Nazi white supremacists in a television address today, in which he insisted on first emphasizing what a great economy he has created before addressing the burning issue of Charlottesville as if it were an afterthought. A witness who was part of the interfaith protest by clergy who faced Saturday's phalanx of heavily armed white supremacist stormtroopers spewing racist hatred, Brian Mann, joins us. He is in his sixth year of studies at the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College in Boston and will be an ordained rabbi in June of 2018. With his prayer shawl and kippah linking arms with other clergy led by Cornel West, Brian faced the Nazi taunts of blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, as he describes how the police did nothing to protect the counter-protesters who were defended by the Antifa, the anti-fascists who came to their rescue, meeting violence with violence, which has led many, including Trump, to assign blame to, quote, many sides. Then we'll examine the rumors of palace intrigue that suggest the alt-right radicals close to Trump, Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller, and the fascist sympathizer Sebastian Gorka might be on their way out of the White House. Addie Baird, a reporter for Think Progress, where she has an article, The Subtle Dog Whistle of Trump's Belated Condemnation of White Supremacists, joins us to discuss today's nasty tweets by Trump, who went after the only black member of his manufacturing council, the CEO of Merck Pharma, who resigned to protest the president's reaction to what happened in Charlottesville. Then finally, we'll look into the emerging right-wing media juggernaut being enabled by Trump's FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, that will effectively become the Ministry of Truth for the Trump presidency. Timothy Carr, the campaign director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com coalition, joins us to discuss how Ajit Pai's changing of the rules to allow Sinclair Broadcasting Group to buy up Tribune will create a monopoly that, along with Fox News and Breitbart, will pump out pro-Trump propaganda and create a Putin-like media machine of alternative facts while attacking the rest of the free press as fake news. And joining us now is Brian Mann, who's currently in his last year of a six-year program of studies at the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College in Boston, Massachusetts. He'll be ordained as a rabbi in June of 2018. He served as an Israel Fellow of Atrua, the Rabbinical Call for Human Rights, and served as a lay leader of the Moshe Kavod House, a social justice-based Jewish community, and Keshet Boston, devoted to the full inclusion of LGBT Jews in Jewish life. He's just returned to Boston after joining counter-protesters at the white supremacy rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, on Saturday. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Mann.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And Brian, you and some of your colleagues decided to go to Charlottesville. Obviously, you knew ahead of time what was going to happen there, at least in terms of this white supremacist rally. So let's talk about what happened on Saturday, just take it from here. You and your colleagues gathered as this gathering of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, people waving both the swastika and the Confederate flag, dressed in military gear, many with high-powered military-style weapons. And there you are with your colleagues confronting them, and you have what, the prayer shawl and your kippah, your yarmulke on, and you're pretty clear how you're identifying yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So we had gathered for a sunrise service where Dr. Cornel West, who put out the call for 1,000 clergy to come in Charlottesville in solidarity, preached, and then we gathered as clergy to kind of prepare ourselves and marched from that church down to confront everyone that you just mentioned. And so once we got there, we formed a line on a single file line with our arms linked on one side of Emancipation Park, where basically directly in front of us were the militiamen in their uniforms with their high-powered rifles. And then the park is raised. So there was like a small kind of wall-ish thing. And on the grass, kind of above us, were barricades with state police behind the state police more barricades, and then where many of the white supremacists, Nazis, neo-Nazis, alt-right, fascists, call them what you will, were gathered and standing. But, you know, don't get me wrong, even though we were locked arms below them, they started, you know, chanting and marching behind us through the streets around us. They came up to us at points. I was, you know, I heard people say, you know, well, oh, look, it's a bunch of kikes. So obviously they saw my tally and saw my kippah and, you know, used a slur for Jews. And they also said things like, what is this every, you know, lesbian minister who's ever been ordained? So very clear homophobia and heterosexism on display. And obviously with their chants of, you know, blood and soil and you will not replace us, very clear racism as well. It was scary. It was terrifying.
Well, they were also chanting, Jews will not replace us. So do you have any concept of what this idea of being replaced means?
Thank God I don't share their brain, so I can't speak from that perspective. But my understanding is that what they believe is they believe that there is a quote-unquote demographic genocide happening because, you know, there are more and more, you know, people of color, Hispanic people, Jews, minorities, queer people, I'm sure they'd even say, you know, either coming into this country or being born in this country or being proud of their identity in this country. And so they see it as, you know, a quote-unquote genocide of white people is some of their language, or that, you know, because of the way demographics are working, or because of, you know, more marginalized identities being accepted on college campuses or for whatever reason, that, you know, white culture, quote-unquote, and white people, quote-unquote, are getting replaced, or their ideology is being replaced, or their, you know, whatever is being replaced by what, ideology of love, ideology of acceptance, ideology of tolerance, ideology that celebrates all people.
Well, I spoke yesterday with a professor from University of Virginia, Charlottesville, who also witnessed this alt-right, which actually I don't, you know, approve of that term, the alt-right. That's, I think, that term that they want to be called themselves, because they clearly are neo-Nazis and fascists and whatever terms you want to apply. But certainly I wouldn't give them the benefit of the doubt of calling them what they want to be called. But she was telling me, though, that she saw these thugs beat up a young African-American man literally in front of the police station, and the police did nothing. So was that your impression, that the police were not really engaged in? You said they were there as a sort of barricade, but the melee did take place, did it not?
Look, I'm going to be completely honest and say no. It was the police that gave the Nazis and neo-Nazi groups, like, the legal permit to be there, right? They were the ones that said, this is legal, this is allowed. It was really the Antifa that came through and really protected not only, not only the marginalized communities at threat, not only the people of color, the queer people, but also the clergy. I wasn't with this group of clergy when they did this, but as things got violent, my colleagues and friends went out into the streets in their robes to use their bodies to protect marginalized identities. So I wasn't there to see this, but as some things were described to me, they would, you know, go out with the intention of putting their bodies between white supremacists and, you know, people most at threat, people of color, visibly Jewish people, visibly queer people, so on and so forth. And if white supremacists tried to, you know, get violent with the clergy or move the clergy so that they could continue beating on people, Antifa would move in and protect the clergy with violence on those white supremacists, get them to back off. They really stepped up and protected the community and protected the clergy in huge, huge ways. So, you know, to your point about police, like, the police really did not step in until the Antifa came through, got the Nazis to incite violence, and that's how the rally got shut down, right, Richard Spencer didn't get to speak because the Antifa incited enough violence that, and the Nazis responded with enough violence that the police made this, again, previously legally permitted rally where they said, sure, Nazis, come on through, illegal.
Right, but a lot of the coverage is, sort of pointed out or tried to point out that the Antifa and the Nazis kind of cancel each other out. They're equally violent, and that was one of the, perhaps one of the reasons why President Trump himself tried to say there was violence on many sides. He said it again, on many sides. So that is not a fair description of the Antifa, according to what you're saying.
No, not at all. In my mind, right, like, the Antifa isn't just randomly attacking people. The Antifa aren't beating down black people in a parking garage of their own accord. The Antifa aren't, you know, coming through the streets of Charlottesville every day for months now, targeting and inciting violence in the streets. They came through strategically. They made enough noise and gave enough awareness of who they were that anyone, including clergy, that did not want to be there when things got violent, could clear out. People were able to clear out before they got there, and they went and they targeted white supremacists and Nazis. They weren't just some mob looting or beating things up or, you know, destroying things willy-nilly. They were strategic, they were planned, they were organized, and they protected us. And some clergy, who I don't think want to be on record, but some clergy after the fact have said they literally saved our lives.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Mann, who's currently in his last year of a six-year program of studies at the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College in Boston, Massachusetts. He'll be ordained as a rabbi in June of 2018. He's just returned from Boston after joining counter-protesters at the white supremacy rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, on Saturday. So what is the problem, then, you think, with the president not recognizing and trying to equate your side, if you will, with their side as being equally violent? And particularly when the neo-Nazis were carrying swastikas, I mean, you'd have to have total historical amnesia not to know that the Nazis resulted in the deaths of about 50 million people, including hundreds of thousands of U.S. service people during World War II. The Confederacy is not a lot better. That was the greatest death toll per capita in the history of America, the Civil War. And yet they're proudly waving the insignias of a genocidal maniac to protect a statue from a traitor who led this country into a civil war that cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of young Americans on both sides. Again, still the highest per capita death rate in any war, including all the wars combined, the Civil War itself. So that's what I find extraordinary, that are we just, as Santa Ana said, if you don't understand history, you're condemned to repeat it? What's the problem here with this historical amnesia?
Yeah, I mean, right, this is the same president that when David Duke called out to endorse him and told white supremacists and neo-Nazis and fascists to go out and vote for him, said, you know, I don't know who David Duke is, you know, right? He at every point up until and including the day of white supremacists that murdered people, let's not forget Heather Heyer. Let's not forget that, you know, not everyone came out of this alive. Let's not forget the many black and brown people who were injured that day by these fascists, right? And we have a president who, on that day, refused to say the words white supremacy, refused to say the words neo-Nazis, refused to say the word fascism. And long before in his campaign, right, I think many of us who were paying attention saw the writing on the wall, could read between the lines, could see what he was saying. And to your point, right, we're seeing kind of either signs or shirts or whatever of the Confederate flag and the American flag together, or a Nazi flag and the American flag together. And some of these people are trying to claim that they're, you know, proud Americans trying to, you know, stand up for American, you know, culture and dignity or whatever. And my favorite response to that on Twitter is, we literally fought a war over this. Or as my friends corrected, we literally joined a war over this. you can't support the U.S. and the ideals that the U.S. stand for and also be a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist or a Klansman or a fascist, because those don't go together. And I can't say much about what goes on in our president's brain, and I don't know how much of it is, you know, willful ignorance, how much it is he is trying to preserve his base for the next election. But, you know, to have a spokesperson for the White House come out, you know, a day later to denounce white supremacy versus doing it yourself, really doesn't sit well in my book.
Well, of course, on Monday, the president did somewhat grudgingly use the words neo-Nazis and white supremacists in his condemnation, but he insisted, apparently, on starting his address by talking about how great the economy was and taking credit for it. And it was an extraordinary display of tone deafness that the whole country, if not the whole world, is focused on this outrage and this idea that these atavistic remnants of a disgusting past, whether it's the Ku Klux Klan, who, by the way, murdered and tortured African-Americans, or the Confederate generals, or the genocidal Hitler and the Nazis, that's what's got everybody's attention. So how did you find President Trump's address today? Did it do anything to recover from this extraordinary lapse on his part? Not to mention conflating both sides as being equally guilty.
I'll be honest and say that I was still on my travels back from Charlottesville today, so I haven't gotten a chance to fully read or watch the president's remarks today. But, you know, what I was seeing was commentary on the Daily Stormer and commentary from neo-Nazi and white supremacist Twitter accounts praising Donald Trump's initial many-side statement. They were thanking him and praising him and saying, you know, he made it sound like the Antifa are just as bad as us. We've essentially won. Right? And I think that first impressions and first remarks are what counts. That's what's going to get the attention. That's what people are going to pay attention to, is what is said in the moment during of. And, you know, I already saw friends of mine saying, you know, it's a day too late. I think that really the community of Charlottesville and those of us there and the clergy in the room all needed to hear him say the words white supremacy, fascism, and have a very firm and strong denouncement. I mean, the clergy booed his response in the day of. We did. Like, we all booed. And I also want to uphold the fact that, you know, my God, I'm in Boston, and Boston is now organizing for this free speech rally on Saturday. So we're not ignoring it. We're not as removed from it as I thought I would be. But Charlottesville has been, you know, confronting these people since May. I have friends down there on the ground who are experiencing trauma every day of their lives. And yeah, this was big and it was scary and it got the biggest response. And, you know, very, very sadly and very mournfully, someone died, but the fascists are still there, and the fascists are still going to be there, and they live there. And one of my friends said, you know, look, if you live in this country, you live near fascists. You live near white supremacists. They're in your community just as much as they're here. We mobilized. We got together. We have been doing this work since May, essentially, and other communities need to also. Right, Boston, we have this, you know, quote-unquote free speech rally coming up, and we're mobilizing, and we are organizing, and we're getting ready to do what we need to do to confront them here in Boston. But we also need to, everyone, everywhere in this country, needs to be aware of who the white supremacists are in their neighborhood, who they're working with, who they're seeing on the streets, what is their ideology, who they're related to. And really start having some very real and very serious conversations about white supremacy and fascism and why none of this is okay, if anything's ever going to change.
Well, just in closing, it seems that the white supremacists have not learned anything, that there's no even concept of repentance and shame, particularly over the death of the young 32-year-old woman, Heather High, that you mentioned. She, of course, was killed in a terrorist-style attack with a car, which we've seen ISIS use in Europe, and at least those ISIS have claimed that their people did these acts, both in London and in France and in Berlin as well. Hardly any difference in terms of methodology. And in terms of the continuing hatred that pours forth from these people, on the Daily Stormer that you mentioned, the neo-Nazi website, they referred to Heather High, the young woman who was killed in this horrible way by the 20-year-old American neo-Nazi from Ohio. They described her as a fat, childless, 32-year-old slut. I mean, where does this hatred come from?
That's a really good question, and I don't know, but I feel like what I need to say in response to that is that doesn't feel so different to me than when a person of color is murdered by police and all the media outlets immediately talk about their criminal record or immediately talk about, you know, he seems like a loner or he maybe did drugs that one time or, you know, he has a felony charge for shoplifting or, you know, she did X, Y, or Z, right? The media can spin any story any way they want. And it's not surprising to me that a hate-filled website would spin and talk about, you know, and talk about a murdered woman in this way, because unfortunately it doesn't feel so different than the way that the mainstream media talk about the deaths of people of color. And, you know, where does this hate come from? I don't know how it could be stopped. I mean, we've seen reports from the mom of one of the white supremacists who is now known, say, you know, I don't know, I didn't know what he was going to. I thought it had something to do with Trump, right? She did not talk to him about what he was going, why he was doing it, where his views were. And I think that's where it starts. It starts with us talking to those closest to us, our immediate family, our friends, our coworkers, our neighbors. And it's hard. It's really friggin' hard to talk about white supremacy and talk about racism in this country as white people or even as white passing people. But if we don't do it, our children, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers go to a white supremacist rally carrying torches, and that's worse.
Well, Brian Band, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Mann, who's currently in his last year of a 6-year program of studies at the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College in Boston, Massachusetts. He'll be ordained as a rabbi in June of 2018, and he served as an Israel Fellow for Torah at the Rabbinical Call for Human Rights and served as a lay leader of the Moshe Chavod House, a social justice-based Jewish community, and also Keshet Boston, an organization devoted to the full inclusion of LGBT Jews in Jewish life. He's just returned from Boston after joining counter-protesters at the white supremacy rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, on Saturday. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the rumors of palace intrigue that suggest the alt-right radicals close to Trump might be on their way out of the White House.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Well, I'm gonna tell you fascists, you may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes.
All you fascists bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Addie Baird, a reporter for Think Progress, who previously covered local politics and health policy at Politico and worked for The Charlie Rose Show. Her latest article at Think Progress is The Subtle Dog Whistle in Trump's Belated Condemnation of White Supremacists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Addie Baird.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for joining us, Addie. And what do you make of this palace intrigue that the knives are being sharpened to get rid of Stephen Bannon, perhaps Stephen Miller, and even Sebastian Gorka?
You know, it's interesting. This is kind of a classic story in the Trump administration. It's funny to call it a classic story because we're just 8 months in. But this is genuinely a story that we've heard a million times with different characters over the last 8 months and during the campaign as well. Trump has basically created these competing power centers within the White House, and the same thing existed in the campaign. You have the Bannon camp, you have the Kushner camp, you have the Reince-Priebus camp and the Scaramucci camp, and so you have these power centers, and they're all sort of competing with each other. In a lot of ways, people who are close to Trump have said, as well as reporters who have covered him for a long time, like Magnus Haberman. But, they've said that the president thrives on this sort of chaos. So this doesn't really surprise me. This, seems like it would be a long time coming, that, eventually Bannon, Gorka, they would be, Stephen Miller, this power center, the kind of nativist, white nationalist-infused power center in the White House would eventually be, have the knives turned against them, just as there's been stories of them trying to oust, Kushner types or Reince-Priebus types, and at times they've been successful.
Well, it was pretty conspicuous over the Sunday talk shows that General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, was asked three times by Chuck Todd of Meet the Press whether he supported Stephen Bannon or not. And he rather obviously but somewhat deftly avoided answering that question, to the point where it was pretty obvious that he wasn't going to say anything nice about this guy.
Exactly, yeah.
But my sense is that the real power behind the scene, I'm of the mind that essentially three plutocrats in this country essentially bought the United States government. The two Koch brothers bought the Congress, and Robert Mercer, I suppose to some extent his daughter Rebecca, bought the executive branch. These are powerful people. Clearly the Congress is enacting the Koch brothers' agenda and nothing else.
Right.
And I wouldn't discount the power and influence of Robert Mercer. He's about to put up $300 million to get rid of one Republican senator, Jeff Flake. So I don't imagine if Bannon is his protege, which I understand to be the case, along with Kellyanne Conway, that the guy's on solid ground.
Well, I think you're very right about that. You can't ever discount, especially in Republican politics, which caters so often to these mega donors, like you mentioned, like the Koch brothers, like Robert Mercer. It's built for these people to funnel money into the party, into candidates, into these challengers, like the challenger to Senator Flake. And it's really built in this way, and you can never discount the power that they have. The Koch brothers, I think we've talked about a bit more because there was a lot of excellent reporting and by Jane Mayer at The New Yorker. She's also written about Robert Mercer. But, she kind of exposed how much influence the Koch brothers really had. But I think you're right on the money. We can never discount the power of the money of powerful people in politics.
So where does that leave Sebastian Gorka, this man with obvious fascist sympathies? He's often been described as a Hungarian fascist. And just only last Wednesday on Breitbart Radio, he said in response to what Maggie Haberman of The New York Times had written about this idea that Gorka had dismissed the idea of lone wolf terrorists. That's all part of this,
right,
this Muslim Islamic conspiracy.
Right.
And he went on to say, it's this constant, oh, it's the white man, it's the white supremacist, that's the problem. No, it isn't, Maggie Haberman. So that's only a week ago. Now, is he saying that now, I wonder? I mean, what has anybody heard anything from Gawker since this Charlottesville outrage?
You know, I personally haven't seen, you know, I haven't, you know, with my eye on cable news, I haven't seen a Gawker interview recently over, you know, today or yesterday, but he really is everywhere. I would not be surprised if I have just missed him. I wrote a long piece kind of looking at his resurgence after it was reported that he was a sworn member of this Nazi allied group in Hungary. And he was just eventually kind of rose from the ashes right around the time that the news about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Kremlin connected lawyer was reported. He kind of emerged from the ashes and was just on cable television all the time. And it continues to be that way. And Trump reportedly just loves him. And to answer your question about where this chaos and this palace intrigue leads Sebastian Gorka, what he has on his side is that the president loves him. He loves that he will attack the media. He loves that he will defend the president, that he will go into the lion's den, and he won't cower. And Trump reportedly just adores him. No one really knows what Sebastian Gorka does in the White House. He is apparently a national security advisor. He's kind of a strategist for Bannon, but no one is totally sure. What he is functionally is a spokesperson for the president, and Trump loves him as a spokesperson. So I think that does keep him safe. However, he is part of this Bannon camp, and there was some reporting today, basically, that if Bannon is out, it's happening within a week, or you know, he'll be if he can survive this week, he can survive this presidency. But if Bannon is out, I don't think that Gorka survives. He is definitely part of this nativist Bannon camp that definitely, you know, many people would say that they have these kind of fascist sympathies and Nazi sympathies. And they, you know, are always quick to point out what they always call radical Islamic terrorism. They have stayed very quiet. Much of the White House has stayed very, very quiet since this terrorism over the weekend in Virginia.
Well, I don't think Gawker has a security clearance, so it'd be pretty hard for him.
He does not.
Yeah, so he can't really.
So that's the thing.
Yeah, what kind is that
he really functionally is a spokesperson for the president.
Right. And it's clearly McMaster that wants to get rid of him. He's managed to get rid of a few of them, at least with the help of the new chief of staff, Kelly. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe the adults are finally being listened to. I don't know. I mean, I'm skeptical about that.
I am as well. This is another kind of classic story of the Trump presidency is someone is ousted, someone else comes into power, and there's always the story that they're going to rein in the president. And I worked on a story with a colleague of mine last week. Basically, we found everyone who, since the start of the campaign, was reportedly going to rein in Trump. It is very easy to find these stories of someone talking to reporters at Politico or The Times saying, you know, Kelly or Bannon, well, it was never really Bannon. It was Manafort, Melania, Jared and Ivanka. They were always going to rein in Trump. And very quickly, Trump gets his phone back. Everyone loves to joke that they try to take his phone away. But very quickly, Trump is back on Twitter, and he is tweeting whatever he wants to say. No one can rein him in. And so when we talk about the adults in the room, I think that, you know, I have no doubt that Kelly and McMaster are trying, but I don't think that, you know, like I said, that Trump has any interest in calming the chaos in his own White House.
Well, Trump started out tweeting today, no mention, of course, of Charlottesville. And then he goes out and attacks the only African-American in his manufacturing council, this fellow Ken Frazier of Merck Pharma, who I think is probably on the President's Manufacturing Council because he is an African-American. But he obviously couldn't handle what Trump hadn't done in response to Charlottesville.
Right.
And quit. And then Trump made this nasty dig at him saying, talking about Merck, lower prices, lower rip-off drug prices, et cetera.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which I'm sure was a conversation they'd never had prior to that.
Maybe
Trump might even be familiar with the blue pill that has made Merck so rich. But in any case, what is your sense then of what he said today? It seemed like his television address, belated as it was rather grudging. And he started out the address by talking about how great the economy was and how he's responsible for turning this country around. And it was almost like the apology or making up for not even naming who really was behind the tragedy in Charlottesville came as sort of as an afterthought.
First of all, he loves to do that. He loves to slide in whenever he has to talk about something he's not really interested in discussing. He loves to slide in, you know, that the economy is doing well, that the Dow is reaching a historic high. So this is one of his favorite things. It's one of my favorite versions of this was when he signed the Russia sanctions into law. He wrote this long statement that was very begrudging, making it very clear that he was not interested in signing these sanctions into law, that they were, you know, wasn't up to him. And at the end of it, he said something along the lines of, I built a great business and, you know, I make great deals and, you know, just totally off topic, but he loved to throw that in. And he did the same thing today. He, you know, opened it up saying, you know, the economy is booming, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the most interesting things here was, of course, this is 48 hours after a woman was killed. These were violent clashes. The White House resisted even naming the KKK, white nationalists and neo-Nazis who, you know, were the organizers of this event. The woman who was killed was a counter-protester. So this really kind of was, a little too late for a president, especially one who has made such he's talked so many times about how President Obama needed to name the enemy. He needed to say radical Islamic terrorism. And for him to basically do the same thing over the weekend, there's sort of a general agreement that the woman who was killed, it was a terrorist attack. And it took him 2 days to name the enemy, to even say the words white nationalists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the statement really was begrudging. And one of the most interesting things was there's a website called Stormfront. It's a popular white nationalist website. And in his comments today, he said, you know, we denounce all hate groups, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, and white nationalists, among others. And, of course, very quickly after this statement, you know, the posters were chatting on a forum on Stormfront, and one of them was very quick to say, you know, he had to say it, but he left himself an out, and he left us an out, to still say the KKK, white nationalists, they are part of violence on many sides, which was his original comment. And, you know, very quickly, these supporters of his who are at the very far extreme, made good with what those comments were and felt that he had left them an out.
And, of course, he did not frame the attack with the car mowing down protesters, killing the young woman from Charlottesville as an act of terrorism, which it clearly was. Adibed, I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Adibed, who's a reporter for Think Progress, who previously covered local politics and health policy at Politico and worked for The Charlie Rose Show. Her latest article at Think Progress is The Subtle Dog Whistle in Trump's Belated Condemnation of White Supremacists. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the emerging right-wing media juggernaut being enabled by Trump's FCC chairman, Ajit Pai. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Timothy Carr, who is the Campaign Director for Free Speech and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. He also writes for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, MediaCitizen.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Carr.
Hi, Ian. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, thank you, Timothy. And the New York Times ran a fairly extensive piece on Monday on Sinclair Broadcasting Group, owned by David D. Smith, and the extent to which Ajit Pai, the head of the FCC, is going to enable them to become an incredibly powerful broadcasting network and break the FCC limit of how many cities and how much of a footprint one broadcast can have. Now, with the purchase of Tribune, they will have the biggest media footprint in the country, will they not, in terms of television?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people have never heard of Sinclair Broadcast Group. They have sort of flown under the radar, but they are the nation's largest owner of local television stations. They own ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, local affiliates across the country. At the moment, they have more than 170 stations under their umbrella. Should the merger go through for the Tribune stations, they will have 233 local stations reaching 70% of the country. And the reason that that's a problem is because there are actual limits put in place by the Federal Communications Commission that limit reach to national reach to 39%. Their merged entity would have nearly twice that reach.
But the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, he boasted that he was going to take a weed whacker to net neutrality rules and other media regulations when it took over the helm of the FCC. And I wonder about when you see these kind of attempts at some ideological justification for what you're doing, that it has something to do with free enterprise. I mean, creating monopolies has nothing to do with free enterprise.
And no, absolutely not. And the FCC's mandate when it comes to oversight of local television broadcasting is to promote localism, to promote diversity, and to promote competition. And the idea of creating a monopoly broadcaster on the scale of Sinclair runs counter to all of those objectives. And the irony about this quote, he said he was going to take a weed whacker to regulations. One of the first things that the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, did upon coming into office with the Trump administration was actually to reimpose a new regulation, a somewhat arcane regulation called the UHF discount, that allowed a company like Sinclair to undercount the number of stations that it had. So, you know, his weed whacker must not have been working that day, because he imposed a regulation in order to meet an ideological objective. And that objective is, of course, to create a conservative voice in local television that has the largest reach of local broadcasters, more so than any other in this country.
Well, my sense is that you know, this kind of, you know, the using sort of free market ideology and other kind of libertarian principles, if that's the right way to put it, disguises the fact that these guys are just whores and hirelings of the rich and powerful. I mean, Colin Powell's son wasn't much better. I mean, he was flying around in Warner Brothers jet and making all kinds of pro-industry deals. What is it about these people that seem to be so willing to sell out the public? Because they're essentially there to serve the American public, not a group of bilious billionaires who want to impose their angry, toxic views on the American people.
Well, they were appointed by the leadership of the Republican Party, which is largely in service of those billionaires and large corporations. Ajit Pai, the current chairman of the FCC, in a former life was a lawyer for Verizon. So he has always favored very large corporations, not this idea, you know, this libertarian ideal of competing companies doesn't quite meet the Pai standard. Pai standard is to do anything he can to help very large and powerful media conglomerates to expand their control over communications in this country to the extent that we have near monopoly providers of cable internet access, near monopoly providers of phone-based internet services, and now increasingly looks like we have a monopoly emerging to control local television. And so we have a situation where we have someone in control at the FCC, and he will serve his time there for a couple of years. And what usually happens with these people is once they leave public service, they go directly into private sector jobs offered by the same companies that they were in office and in public service to regulate. So either Chairman Pai has a political future, there's rumors that he wants to run for Congress once he leaves, or he has a cushy job at one of these companies waiting for him the moment he finishes his service at the FCC.
So let's talk about how what this is going to do, though, this merger with Sinclair and Tribune and their extraordinary reach. And Sinclair already has shown that it has almost sort of militant far-right wing opinions, which it wants to impose. I mean, this is the great tragedy of American broadcasting, was that, you know, the Fairness Doctrine, which FDR brought in, and of course he was attacked by Colonel McCormick and Father Cochran and all these incredibly virulently hateful right-wing agitators. And then so they came up with this brilliant solution, which is if you own a media corporation and a bunch of TV stations, in those cases mostly newspapers and radio, if you own any media assets that you have to, broadcast media, if you want to use them as your personal soapbox, you have to offer up equal time to the opposing point of view. And that had the effect of moderating political speech. And then you have Reagan in 87 getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine at the urging of Rupert Murdoch and others. The right-wingers were absolutely hit the ground running. They knew exactly what was going on, and that it led directly to Rush Limbaugh and to Fox News and to this polarization in our political discourse that is crippling this country. And you'd only have to look at what happened in Charlottesville to see how much poison is being spread out there in the media today. And it all can be traced back to getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine. So that is the way that I see it, is that, you know, now we've got these people like Murdoch who feel that they have every right and the power to impose their personal political views or their pro-corporate propaganda to increase their own bottom line on the American public without any sense of social responsibility. And of course, this guy Smith is even worse. He's even more virulent than Rupert Murdoch.
Well, that's why my organization, Free Press, filed a petition to deny this merger with the FCC last week. We believe that the goal of the FCC is to promote diversity of opinion, diversity of viewpoints, localism, and competition. And it's very clear that they have lost sight of that goal when you see a company like Sinclair. Interestingly, Sinclair hired a former Trump administration staffer, a fellow by the name of Boris Epstein, who is now creating a commentary segment which basically trumpets the views of President Donald Trump in a 2 to 3 minute commentary segment that is then shipped out to Sinclair's extensive network of local television stations with a must-run mandate. That is to say that all of these stations, it's now 170, could very well be 223, will have to run this pro-Trump basic propaganda for the Trump administration over their local television news in order to meet the standards placed upon them by this monopoly-minded broadcast owner.
Well, as you know, Tim Carr, there's a lot of rumors and investigations swirling around Trump and some possible collusion with the Russians. There's a special counsel looking into it. There's been a great deal of speculation about the ties. But there does seem to be a real tie. Obviously, the Russians still use their bots and their troll farms to infect the political debate in this country through social media and using Facebook, etc. So that will continue. But it seems that in many ways that Trump is trying to create what Putin has successfully done in Russia and what Erdogan has done in Turkey, and what many of these despots do, which is can take over the media. And of course, this is also now happening in Hungary and in Poland. So this is on the march, this idea of the Ministry of Truth taking over, where the government propaganda becomes the only game in town. Now, we still have some diversity left, but if Trump is able to use Sinclair, the expanded version thanks to Ajit Pai, Fox, Breitbart, and all these other clones, plus Limbaugh and right-wing talk radio, he's got a pretty powerful political operation going in terms of propaganda that could actually have a pretty strong effect in creating an alternative reality and alternative facts as he throws red meat to his base on a daily basis.
Well, for a lot of Trump supporters, that alternative reality already exists. But what Trump's goal is, on the one hand, is to take down traditional media like CNN, like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, by calling them fake news at every turn, while at the same time propping up what is propaganda, essentially, for Donald Trump. And this Sinclair network, which is being eased forward by Trump's chairman at the FCC, Ajit Pai, is effectively Trump TV, and that's something that we've been calling it in and around my office, is Trump TV. It really is a local broadcast network that can reach tens of millions of Americans, more than 100 million Americans, and espouse this view that everything that Trump says is okay, and it's just the liberal elite and fake news media that are against him. So he's very much in favor of what he considers real news, what most of the rest of the world would consider propaganda, while at the same time taking legitimate, you know, news organizations that operate by some standards of journalism and then trying to discredit them by calling them fake news. This is all part of Trump's plan to appear to be a successful president in the eyes of this alternative facts media.
Well, but could he pull it off, in other words, in spite of the fact that he's dangerously incompetent? And frankly, I'm astounded at how most of the coverage about North Korea has not pointed out the obvious, which indicates how much he's getting away with. This whole North Korean hysteria was deliberately ginned up by the Trump administration. They leaked the Defense Intelligence Agency report to the Washington Post, and then Trump was able to use that as a way to respond with all this bellicosity and attacking Kim Jong-un, who's hardly the most popular guy on the planet, along with the mullahs in Tehran. These are easy targets to whip up hatred because they spend all their day saying terrible things about the United States as though, you know, the most powerful nation on the earth is somehow vulnerable to the taunts from these marginal lunatics. But still, it's playing. You know, you got people in Hawaii thinking about building bomb shelters. You got all this nonsense going on about nuclear war, and it's all ginned up by Trump with the help of the media. And I'm not just talking about the right-wing pro-Trump media, but the whole media is falling for it. And it's distracting America and the press from the Russia story, which is exactly the intention on the part of Trump. So he's actually, not only does he have his own propaganda arm, his own Ministry of Truth, his own Pravda in Fox and Sinclair, he's also pretty damn good at manipulating the rest of the press.
Well, he is the president of the United States, but he does know that this sort of tough talk and nuclear brinksmanship will distract from the other reality, which is, of course, an ongoing investigation into collusion between the Trump campaign, the Trump administration, and powerful Russian interests. That story is ongoing. As you know, any time the threat of nuclear war looms, you know, that is of a great concern. Unfortunately, we have the person who has his finger over the button with virtually no experience in the sort of international statecraft that is required to reasonably and thoughtfully navigate these very sort of high tension moments. And you're right, a lot of it has been set up by the Trump administration so that he can appear, at least to his base, to be a very strong leader. But the reality is that we have two very unstable people who have power over nuclear weapons who are going at one another in a way that could lead to a very, very, I'm saying this euphemistically, very unfortunate result.
Well, don't get me wrong, Timothy. I think the man, Trump, is reckless, dangerous, ignorant, and frightening. And he is playing with fire simply to distract the American people from his own incompetence. And this couldn't be more dangerous. You don't play with this with nuclear fire. It's unconscionable what's happening. But I was more or less indicating that it can be done, and you're right, it's because he holds this office, which he just disgraced by not speaking out earlier on the shameful behavior of the white nationalists and neo-Nazis in Charlottesville. But I guess what I wanted to find out just in closing is, do you think that Trump, with his own propaganda arm via Fox and Sinclair and Breitbart, etc., and with voter suppression, with the untold billions that Robert Mercer's about to throw at him. He's also basically funded his election in the first place and pretty much has bought the executive branch. Mercer's putting up $300 million, apparently, to defeat Republican Senator Jeff Flake. So Trump's got unlimited money, a big media megaphone, voter suppression, and he could start a little war somewhere, a little wag the dog war, maybe with Iran. Obviously, North Korea is not a good idea, and maybe even Trump knows that. Well, of course, he did threaten Venezuela. Who knows what he's going to do? But do you see what I'm saying? The combination.
No, I think we're in a very dangerous time with a leader who seems very, very unstable. And his only concern is to sort of rewrite the history books in a way that makes him appear as a successful president. Public polling, fortunately, shows that he is not successful in winning the war of public opinion. So hopefully, you know, his efforts to manipulate the media to create these sorts of propaganda outlets won't succeed in fooling the majority of Americans, and certainly not the majority of voters. But as you've mentioned, there are other efforts underway under this administration to disenfranchise large swaths of voters, voters who are from communities of color or low-income families who typically do not vote Republican. So these are very dangerous times, and it requires vigilance and activism on the parts of not just the sort of media organizations, activists that my organization, Free Press, works with, but everybody who is concerned about the future of our democracy.
Well, Timothy Carr, thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm your speaker, Timothy Carr, who's the campaign director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. He also writes for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, MediaCitizen.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.